Parshas Tazria has only 67 verses. It's a brisk parsha. There are seven mitzvos, and the content, the subject matter of this week's parsha is somewhat unique because the sole subject is the idea of purity and impurity. It begins with the purity and impurity stemming from childbirth. A woman has a boy, a woman has a girl. There's certain laws governing purity and impurity once the baby's been born. And then chapter 13, which is the rest of the parsha, is dedicated to the laws of purity and impurity stemming from tsaras. Tsaras is some sort of skin malady that is a physical representation of a spiritual ailment, of a spiritual illness. Now, I think it's a good way to kind of introduce ourselves to the subject of purity and impurity. We could look at the very first Rashi's commentary on the parsha. Now, Rashi gives a puzzling statement from our sages. He says that if you go back to Genesis and you look at the order of creation, you'll notice that all the animals are created first. And the very last thing, the very last entity to be created in Genesis is mankind. So you have the animals created first and then mankind. Therefore, says Rashi, we first have the laws of the animals. So at the end of last week's parasha, we have the laws of which animals are kosher, which animals are not kosher. And once the laws of the animals are done, just like they were created before men, their laws are taught before men. And once we concluded the laws of the animals, we're told the laws of the humans. Very intriguing idea that there's a certain parallel between Genesis and the creation of man and animals and Leviticus and the laws governing the purity and impurity of humans and animals. And I think it's kind of odd, you know, what is the connection? What's the connection between Genesis, between the creation of man and the animal kingdom and these laws, the laws governing the purity and impurity of animals and humans? So there's an interesting statement from the Maharal, and he says that when we have Torah, we have laws governing animals, laws governing humans, that in effect is the completion of creation. And that's a deep point here. When we were created with imperfections. And you know what? Animals were also created with imperfections. And therefore, when we have laws governing humans and animals, these are the laws, these are the tools given to us, so to speak, to complete creation, to finish off Genesis, and to achieve what the desire of creation was, is that it should be a hybrid, so to speak. God creates, we perfect with Torah, and therefore there's a natural connection between Genesis and Leviticus, between the creation of animals and men, and between the laws of purity and impurity of animal men, which is their perfection. But I think a question still remains. You know, why indeed was man created last? Why wasn't man created at the beginning of the week of Genesis? So the Talmud in the Book of Sanhedrin, page 38a, gives us four reasons as to why man was created last. It gives reason number one, because if man was created on Wednesday, then the heretics will say, well, who helped God with the creation of Thursday and Friday? That was man. And therefore, to kind of stymie the arguments of the heretics, as if to say that man was a partner with God, man was created last. That's the first answer. Second answer is that if man is haughty, if man gets arrogant, if man becomes full of hubris, then you just tell man, hey, don't get so haughty. After all, the lowly fruit fly, the mosquito, was created before you. That's the second answer. That's why man was created last. The third answer is that man should enter a mitzvah right away. Man's created right before Shabbos, and he could be ushered into Shabbos, into the Sabbath, right after he was created. And finally, the fourth answer of the Talmud is that the reason why man was created last is because man is the goal of creation. And therefore, first you set the table, first you construct the arena, and then you bring in the guest of honor. Man is the guest of honor in God's world, and therefore God created the entire world and then put man in it once the world was completed. Those are the four reasons as to why man was created last, as we're told in the Talmud in the Book of Sanhedrin. And here we say that there's some sort of connection between why man was created last and why the laws of man's Torah, the laws of purity and impurity governing man, are also told last. And it doesn't seem like any of these four answers would apply to here, to the laws of purity and impurity, to the laws of contamination. And therefore, there seems to be a little bit of inconsistency. Mammoth created last, and there's a reason for it. In fact, there's four reasons for it. But the laws of impurity and purity of man don't seem to have that same reason, so it seems to be a little bit inconsistent. And I think that's a good question to springboard the introduction to the Parsha and to the idea of purity and impurity in general. As an aside, besides for our Parsha, we have next week's Parsha that also talks about purity and impurity in various other places in the Torah. But if you look in the Oral Torah, in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, there is a dizzying amount of time and content that's dedicated to the laws of purity and impurity, to these laws of contamination. So like we said, this is Parsha, we have the impurity of a mother after having a baby, and the impurity from the tsaras, from this spiritual disease with physical manifestations on a person's body, a person's garments, a person's house. There are all kinds of other states of purity and impurity. So the most impure thing is a dead human body. There's dead carcasses. Women who menstruate. There's the major zava, the minor zava. These are various irregularities in their cycle. A man who has a seminal emission has a degree of impurity. There's a major and minor zava for a man. Other forms of emissions when someone's ill. And there's all kinds of laws, draconian laws, related to how a person who has these impurities has to behave, how someone with these impurities, how can they could be remedied. You know, the Oral Torah is broken down into the six orders of Mishnah. And one of those orders is the order called Taharos, which deals with impurity and purity. So in effect, you have like 15 to 16% of all of Torah dedicated to these laws. And for us in modern times, I will say, these ideas seem very distant, doesn't seem really tangible or applicable. Now, there are some cases where these laws are very much applicable. So, for example, the Torah tells us that a Kohen, a priest, is not allowed to come into contact with dead people, meaning they can't visit cemeteries. And the laws governing purity and impurity are much more than just touching the dead body, but being in close proximity or even being in the same structure. So if you're in the same building as a dead body, there's this idea that this impurity permeates the entire structure, the entire edifice in which it is contained. And therefore, if you're a Kohen and you're in a building and you find out that someone died, you have to run away out of the building, escape quickly because you can't be in that same building. So for example, this extends even further. In Jerusalem, where I used to live, there was a cemetery that was adjacent to a street, and there was a sign on the street. Because there was trees overhanging on both the cemetery and the street next to it, a Kohen, because of the laws of impurity governing a structure, those would preclude the Kohen from walking under the trees, even though he's not in the cemetery. But because the trees are covering both the cemetery and the street next to it, walking under the tree would be prohibited. And this actually extends further. You know, someone's in a hospital, the entire hospital, as long as it's connected, they can even be in separate buildings, but if there's some sort of connection between the two, that would unite those buildings as one halachic structure. And if there's a dead body in one of those buildings, then the Kohen can't be in the entire building complex. So those are some laws governing a Kohen and how they have to relate with dead bodies, with cemeteries today. This was a very big deal when the temple was extant, when the sacrifices were in existence. Everyone had to always know the state of purity that they were in, what they could touch, what they cannot touch, what they could eat, where they can go. And even today, if you walk in Israel and you go to the Kotel, you go to the Western Wall, and you want to go onto Temple Mount, there's big signs saying that according to Jewish law, Jews are not allowed to go there. And the reason for that is that the temple grounds retained their purity requirements. And therefore, for someone to walk up there, you would have to be in a state of purity, in a state of purity that we probably cannot achieve today, because the only way to undo the purity of coming into contact with dead bodies is via the red heifer that we'll meet later on in the Torah. And because we don't have a red heifer, we can't become fully cleansed, and therefore we cannot come really too close to temple grounds. So these ideas are not very applicable, but there are some isolated instances where they are applicable. But I think even more broadly, on a philosophical level, the whole notion of purity and impurity seems quite foreign. You know, we associate purity with cleanliness, with hygiene. It's maybe even hard for us to come up with good definitions about what these things even mean. And, you know, we had last week the laws of the kosher foods, and this week with the laws of purity and impurity. These are all like spiritual ideas captured in physical things. You have the physical food. It's a piece of meat, and one piece of meat's kosher, one piece of meat's not kosher. What's the difference between the two? It's not necessarily on a physical level, a physical plane, a physical realm. It's on the spiritual realm. You have someone who has this spiritual ailment, they're perfectly healthy, they're perfectly clean. There's nothing wrong with them from our perspective, yet the Torah says they may be impure. So what's a way to understand the general principle of purity and impurity? And I think, you know, the parsha begins with a woman having a baby, which is a wonderful thing. It's a holy thing. You're bringing a soul into the world. Is there anything greater than having a child? Yeah, the Torah says that if she has a male, she's impure for 7 days. If she has a female, she's impure for 14 days. Why would having a baby render someone impure? Now, in addition, the bulk of the laws of impurity and purity relate only to Jews, and many of them are applicable only in the land of Israel. Clearly, if purity and impurity from the Torah's perspective were about cleanliness, they wouldn't only apply to us. And finally, a third question to ponder is the idea of tzaras, which is going to comprise the bulk of our parsha. Tzaras, we're told in the Talmud, it is a physical illness that comes because of a certain sin. And primarily the sin of Lashon Hara, the sin of evil talk, of talking negatively about other people. Why would tzaras not be prevalent today? After all, people speak Lashon Hara, people speak negatively about other people. And right away, according to the Torah, they should sprout immediately tzaras. It should just show up on their skin, on their garments, on their house. Why is it not prevalent today? So a general rule of thumb that we're told by our commentators, by the sages, of what purity and impurity is and what they portend, what they represent, is that purity is life, is vitality, is potential, and impurity is the lack of life and the lack of potential. So for example, we start off with the mother who just had a baby. So if you look at a pregnant woman, then what do you have? You have two souls. You have the soul of the mother, and then you have the soul of the baby. What happens when the baby's born? So it's fantastic. The baby's nothing wrong with the baby. There's nothing wrong with the mother either. But if you look at the mother just on a purely spiritual plane, if we could put on goggles that showed you just a soul, and you looked at this person, you would see how many souls? You'd see two souls, the soul of the mother, the soul of the baby. If those were your only goggles, and then you see the woman a week later, and she's had a baby, how many souls do you see? You only see one soul. So from a purely spiritual perspective, there was a massive diminishing of the life, of the vitality, of the holiness of the mother. Of course, it's not a bad thing. It's a fantastic thing. But that's the general principle, that there's an absence of holiness, or there is a reduction of holiness. There was holiness. There was life within her. Of course, the life is hopefully flourishing outside of her, but within her, there was a reduction of life, a reduction of potential. Therefore, it's a loss of spiritual vitality, and that is the definition of impurity. It's not dirtiness. It's not nothing wrong. There's no, maybe contamination is the wrong word, but impurity by definition is the reduction of spiritual life, of vitality, of opportunity for greatness, of holiness. A woman menstruates. Well, what's that? Nothing wrong with it. It's very natural, but there was potential for life that has now been diminished, has now been lost. A man has a seminal emission. Again, same pattern. There's life, there's vitality, there's opportunity, there's potential for life, and now that has been reduced, that has been diminished. Someone is alive, they're alive. What is the least pure thing in the world? The most impure thing in the world is a dead body. Why? That thing was alive, there was a soul in it, and the soul has departed. Death is a very normal thing. In fact, every person that's ever lived has died. of course, besides for the ones that are still alive. But everyone, there's nothing wrong with that. Moses died, right? Abraham died. Death is a very normal part of the human experience. But when someone's alive, meaning their soul is still in their body, there is a soul in this body. If you look at that same body, the cadaver, after the soul has departed it, the soul is gone. And as a result, that is the definition of impurity. Again, not dirtiness. It's not that it's unhealthy. It's not that it's unclean. It's not that there's something wrong. It's just a reduction of holiness, reduction of the soul, a reduction of life, a reduction of vitality. And the Ramban, in a very famous essay here, in chapter 13, verse 47, he points out, again, that the idea of tsaras is not something natural at all. In fact, he points out that these afflictions, they contaminate garments. You know, leprosy is a skin disease that still exists, but that doesn't extend to clothing or to someone's house. But this is a spiritual reflection that is manifested in a physical world. And he explains that this is only when the Jewish people are perfect, when the presence of God is upon them. It's real. Their spiritual life is tangible. Those goggles that we talked about, those spiritual goggles are present. They're in the land of Israel and exclusively in the land of Israel. Their spiritual life is heightened. Those people, when they're living in a spiritual way, in a spiritual manner, the spiritual realm is more palpable and therefore reductions in spiritual degrees are more felt. Us today, yes, we still have Lashon Hara, sadly, but what we don't have is that same heightened level of spiritual acuity, and therefore we don't sense it. It's less perceptible to us, and therefore we don't have tsaras today as a immediate consequence of Lashon Hara or other sins. And I think we could look at this general principle as a continuation of the laws of eating kosher foods and avoiding non-kosher foods. There is this, a certain spiritual sensitivity that we have, that we've adopted, that we've absorbed, that we have earned as a result of us being the chosen people, the kingdom of priests and the holy nation. Once we're at that heightened level because of our spiritual acuity, therefore we have all these additional laws. Later on in Leviticus, we're going to read about the land of Israel itself. The land of Israel is a holy land. When we say holy, we mean spiritual. Of course, it's also a physical land. You could plant and you can have agriculture and build roads and aqueducts, whatever. But it's a physical land that also has spiritual power to it. And we're told in later on Leviticus that if people sin, the land itself will expel us. It will vomit us out. And Rashi tells us that, gives us an analogy. You have a prince. The prince is used to eating the finest of foods. And then you give him something which is a little bit underdone. It's a little bit raw. They'll right away get stomach poisoning and they'll start vomiting. Whereas if you take a peasant who's not used to the most delicate of foods, their stomach is a little bit more resolute. It's a little bit more capable of absorbing all kinds of stuff. And therefore, it doesn't expel, it doesn't vomit when the food is not just so. Similarly, you know, if we go to the other lands are not as sensitive. They're not spiritually sensitive to sin. Whereas land of Israel, it's like the stomach, it's like the gut of the prince. It's spiritually potent. And therefore, to the degree of spiritual potence is the degree of spiritual sensitivity to things that are not spiritually okay. Jewish people, we're elevated spiritually. Consequently, we have to behave in a higher level. And therefore, the foods that are wrong spiritually, so to speak, we have to avoid them because it's dangerous for us. Non-Jews, not dangerous for them. They're not as spiritually developed as we are. That's the principle that applies with kosher or non-kosher food. And that's the same idea over here, that because we have a heightened degree of holiness and spirituality, therefore we have a heightened degree of the laws of purity and impurity, the laws of our soul, the laws of that are reflective of the spiritual state of our soul. Perhaps as an example, we could say, you know, if someone is wearing a garment made of sackcloth, it's very hard to see, you know, if there's a stain on the garment. Whereas if someone's wearing the nicest, choicest, finest linen, silk garments, the slightest imperfection, the slightest smudge, The slightest discoloration is already noticed. Again, the higher degree of purity, the more sensitivity you have to have for things that are impure. You take a diamond. It's shiny. It's beautiful. The most beautiful diamond, what do? We take a loop and we magnify them and we examine them very, very, very critically to see if there's any slight blemishes, any slight imperfections. So in effect, the laws of purity and impurity are a reflection and a consequence of being holy, of being special, of being more spiritually developed. The Rambam tells us, Maimonides tells us, in chapter 5 of the Laws of the Foundations of Torah, that there is a concept called Chil Hashem, which means desecration of God's name, and he gives us the laws governing desecration of God's name in general, and then he adds that every person, they have to behave in the degree that is commensurate to their spiritual stature. As someone upgrades other areas of life, they have to upgrade everything else in tandem. If you're someone who is spiritually advanced, you have to live above and beyond the letter of the law, above and beyond the standard practice. You have to behave in a scintillatingly pure and moral fashion. Similar idea that we see over here, the holiness that we inherently have is manifested in these very delicate laws governing the purity and impurity, the minute changes of the spiritual state of our soul. Let's go back to our introductory Rashi. Rashi tells us that there's a connection between Genesis, creation of animals and man, and the laws of purity and impurity of animals and man. I think now we understand the connection quite deeply. Man was created last. If you look at all those reasons, the four reasons that we mentioned from the Talmud, all those four reasons are reflections of man's superiority over animals. We are more special. We are the guests of honor, so to speak, in God's world. We're the ones who do mitzvos. We're the ones, of course, who have the challenges, because we could also go the other way. We could also reject God. But that too is a reflection of the fact that we are created in the image of God, that we have free will, free choice. Therefore, it makes a lot of sense that as a reflection of our specialness, as a reflection of the fact that we are elevated, we have these very draconian laws of purity, because they are governing only someone who is special, only someone who is living in a very heightened state of spirituality. So that's a long way to introduce the idea of purity and impurity that is the dominant theme of our parsha. So the parsha begins, "Speak to the children of Israel. A woman conceives, gives birth to a male. She should be contaminated. She should be impure for a 7-day period." And then on the 8th day, we read in verse number 3, "The flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised." So it begins with the birth of a male and a female, but it interjects with the laws of circumcision. The woman is impure for 7 days, and on the 8th day, the child is circumcised. What is the connection between the 7-day of impurity and the 8th day upon which the child is circumcised? The Talmud tells us in the Book of Nida, page 31, why did the Torah declare that a child is circumcised on day 8? Because we don't want a situation that everyone is happy, because the child's been circumcised, it's a huge party. Everyone's happy, but the father and mother are sad. Why? Because the mother is still suffering, so to speak, from the laws of impurity. Therefore, the Torah waits, so to speak, so everyone could be happy. After 7 days of impurity, you have the 8th day, the woman's pure now, and the child can be circumcised and everyone could be happy. An interesting idea here that the Torah makes laws, so to speak, to ensure peace and love between spouses, harmony. You shouldn't have this asymmetrical party. Everyone else is happy and the mother and the father are miserable. Now, as a general theme, the idea of circumcision on day 8, we're told by the Maharal many, many times, the idea that 7, the number 7 in Jewish philosophy, is always a reference to the natural order of things. Whereas the number 8 is supernatural. It's one more than the natural cycle of 7, and that's supernatural. And by the way, those laws apply for 7 times 7, which is 49, and 50, supernatural. That's the idea of the oval. In addition, you have 7 times 10, 70, and then 71, one more than that, that's the Sanhedrin. So this idea, these numbers appear many, many times in Jewish philosophy, and that's the breakdown. 7 is natural, 8 is supernatural. When we talk about circumcision being on day 8, it's a reference to a child being catapulted to a heightened level of supernaturalness that is going to be exhibited by the circumcision, by the covenant that was forged between Abraham and God. Now, the Talmud tells us another law here that the verse says on the 8th day, the child should be circumcised. What if the 8th day is Shabbos? We know that there's many prohibitions on what I'll do on Shabbos, and one of them is to take a knife and to cut flesh. So are we allowed to circumcise the child on Shabbos? Child's born on Saturday, and 8 days later, because you count day 1, so Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday again, Shabbos again. 8 days later, it's Shabbos again. Could the child be circumcised, or must you wait till the following day? So here, this verse tells us, Ubayom HaShmini, on the 8th day, irrespective of what that day of the week is, the child is circumcised. So I, myself, was born on a Friday night after nightfall, meaning halachically it's on Saturday, and I was indeed circumcised on Saturday. Or so I was told, but I believe my parents, I assume that's true. I have a son that was also born on Shabbos and was circumcised on Shabbos. And that's this law that we see over here, that the 8th day child is circumcised even if it's Shabbos. The law of circumcision overrides the restriction of Shabbos. Now, there are some exceptions here. The Talmud tells us that there is a connection here. The woman is impure for 7. Child is circumcised on day 8. Well, what if the mother does not become impure? So, for example, a woman has a C-section. These laws would not kick in. And therefore, the woman would not have these laws of impurity. And therefore, that child would not be circumcised on Shabbos. The law of circumcision overriding Shabbos does not apply in that instance. Another case where a child would not be circumcised on Shabbos is if we are unsure if the baby was born on Shabbos. So, for example, we know that the night is the beginning of the day halachically. So we start Friday night to Shabbos, even though it's not Saturday, but the day, so to speak, begins with the night. But there is this in-between period, a twilight period between Friday and Saturday, and we're not sure, is it Friday or is it Saturday halachically? If a child is born during those 72 minutes where we're not sure, is it halachically Friday or halachically Saturday, we have a little bit of a dilemma. You can't circumcise a child on Friday, because maybe the child was actually born on Saturday, and therefore Friday would be day 7, and you can't circumcise before day 8. You can't circumcise on Shabbos, because only circumcision of the 8th day overrides Shabbos. Maybe the child was born really on Friday, and therefore Shabbos, the following Shabbos, is day 9, and circumcision of day 9 does not override Shabbos. So a child born in that twilight zone between Friday and Saturday, between Friday and Shabbos, is indeed circumcised on Sunday. It's not day 8 for sure. It's a question if it's day 9 or day 10, but that is the only solution to such a dilemma. Now, the Midrash, on its commentary here in this verse, brings an amazing story between Rabbi Akiva and Turnus Rufus, who was one of the governors of the land of Judah after the destruction of the temple. And he used to have these debates with Rabbi Akiva, and there's several of those debates that are recorded in the Talmud and in various Talmudic literature. So the story goes that Turnus Rufus, this Roman general, this Roman governor, he asked Rabbi Akiva, whose deeds, whose actions are greater, the actions of God or the actions of man? So Rabbi Akiva sensed this was a trick question. And he responded to him, no, the actions of man are greater than the actions of God. So Turnus Rufus wasn't ready for that answer. He says, wait a minute. You know, God created heaven and earth. Can man do that? Of course not. So Rabbi Akiva says, well, that wasn't the question. The question is, in an area where man and God can both operate, which ones are greater? And I say, the actions of man. So that was how Rabbi Akiva initially deflected the conversation. But then Turnus Rufus continued. He says, wait a minute. Why do you circumcise? After all, God delivers babies, so to speak, to us uncircumcised. And you decide that you want to upgrade, so to speak. You want to circumcise the child. Why? So Rabbi Akiva said to him, I knew this was your question. And therefore, I preempted you and I said that the actions of man are greater. And I'll bring you proof. So Rabbi Akiva goes to the field and pulls out a bushel, a bundle of wheat. He goes to the bakery and takes a loaf of delicious bread. And he says to Turnus Rufus, okay, well, which one of these are greater? You have the wheat that was delivered to us by God in this fashion. You want to eat that or you want to eat the bread, which is when humans, we take our role in processing what God gave us, perfecting and upgrading it from being wheat, from being grain, into being bread. Therefore, when we are circumcised as a child, it's the same kind of thing. God delivers it. It's not perfect, and we have to kind of finish it, do that last mile, fulfill the final touches of the child. Child's uncircumcised, and we just kind of finish that last little bit to create perfection. And then Turnus Rufus asks yet a third question. He says, okay, well, if the child is perfected with circumcision, why doesn't God circumcise them ahead of time? Why doesn't the child arrive circumcised? And finally, the Rebbe responds with a very important, valuable insight into Jewish philosophy, because by telling Turnus Rufus that the reason why God gave us mitzvos is that we could perfect ourselves. God, by design, makes us imperfect, and the mitzvos are there that we have a role. We could partner with God to perfect ourselves. And therefore, a child is born imperfect. We circumcise them on the eighth day, and the child is perfected. So if the woman has a male, she's impure for 7 days. If she has a female, she is impure for 14 days. After those days of impurity, there's days of purity. 33 days of purity for a male and 66 days of purity for a female, meaning that any emissions that she has are not emissions that will render her impure. And then once the entire period has concluded, she brings sacrifices to the temple to complete this cycle, so to speak. And there's two sacrifices. One is an ola, which is an elevation offering, and one is a chatas, a sin offering. Why does a woman have to bring a sin offering after having a baby? What's the sin of having a baby? So the Talmud tells us several reasons. Either because in the throes of labor, we assume that she made a vow. And the vow was, because she's in such pain and agony, she committed to never sleep with her husband again, to never have this terrible experience again. And therefore, as a way to atone for what she maybe might have said, she brings a sin offering. Alternatively, perhaps during her painful labor, she blasphemed against God, going back, so to speak, to the time of Eve. Why did God have to cause this to be such a painful experience? And therefore, as a way to atone that, she brings a sacrifice of atonement to cleanse her from that misdeed that she may have done during her labor and delivery. Now, it's interesting that the description of the sacrifice, like we had previously in Leviticus, there's different sacrifices for a rich person and a poor person. Upon the completion of the days of her purity, she brings an elevation offering, a young dove or a turtle dove for a sin offering. So there's a sheep for an elevation offering and a young dove or turtle dove for a sin offering. And then if you read a little bit later on, if she can't afford a sheep, she shall take two turtle doves or two young doves, one for an elevation offering and one for a sin offering. So if you read that, you're like, okay, well, we have the two offerings, and depends. If she's rich, she brings a sheep and a turtle dove or dove. And if she's poor, she brings two turtle doves or two young doves. But if you'll notice, if you read this quite critically, you'll notice there's a little bit of a change here in how these birds are presented. In verse 6, it says a young dove or a turtle dove. And in verse 8, meaning in a case where the woman brings two birds and no sheep, it's turtle doves come first. First, two turtle doves or two young doves. How come the order is switched? How come in verse 8 it has the turtle doves first, and really everywhere else in the Torah has the turtle doves first, and whereas in verse 6 it has the doves first and only then the turtle doves? So the Baal HaTum, one of the commentaries, I think he says a fascinating idea. He says the difference between verse 6 and verse 8 is that in verse 6 the woman's bringing only one bird, whereas in verse 8, the woman's bringing two birds. And it tells us that if you're only bringing one bird, it's better to bring a dove. Why? Because a turtle dove, and this we already saw a little bit earlier in Leviticus, a turtle dove only has one mate. And after that mate has been killed, they won't be with any other bird. That's just the nature of this turtle dove. And therefore, if you take only one, then in effect, you're breaking up a union that's a lifelong union. And therefore, it's better to take a dove. If you're only taking one bird, you take a dove. And only if you can't find a dove, you take a turtle dove. It's just an amazing idea of the sensitivity that we're showing over here, that we don't want to disrupt even the animals from having a wonderful experience, how sensitive we have to be to not cause pain to animals. And therefore, every other place in the Torah, we're told turtle doves, then doves. But when you're only taking one bird, it's better to take a dove and only then a turtle dove, because if you take a turtle dove, then you're going to upend and disrupt some sort of turtle dove union forever. Just an amazing little anecdote here, a little tidbit that we see in the commentaries. So chapter 13 tells us of tzaras, a spiritual malady of the stain. Now the Talmud tells us, the book of Arachin, that there's seven different sins for which these ailments, these spiritual maladies, tzaras comes to a person: on lashon hara, evil talk, on murder, on oaths in vain, on sexual sins, on haughtiness, on theft, and on being very stingy, being very miserly. And these ailments afflict the body, the clothing, and the house. Our parsha is going to deal with the afflictions of the body and the clothing, and next week's parsha, Parsha's Metzora, is going to cover the laws governing tzaras on the house. And this is primarily for Lashon Hara, according to the commentary. So, for example, there's a verse in Deuteronomy that tells, we know the story of Miriam. Miriam was the sister of Moshe, Moses and Aaron, and she spoke negatively about Moses. And there's a verse that tells us that we should remember what God did to Miriam when we left Egypt, that God struck her with tzaras, with this ailment, because she spoke negatively about Moses. In fact, it's a mitzvah in the Torah, says the Ramban in his comment there. It's a mitzvah of the Torah for us to remember the immediate effects that someone speaking Lashon Hara has, at least in the time where the Jewish people are on that spiritual level, that right away there will be a visible spiritual blemish, as was present with Miriam. For us, sin has no tangible manifestation on our lives. And the reason why, it's because our soul is a little bit removed from us. You know, our body is okay with sin. In fact, it's even desirous of sin. For us, mitzvos, the activities desired by our soul, may feel awkward, a little bit out of place. The more spiritual we get, the more we begin to feel what our soul feels, and the more it affects us in a tangible and real palpable way. You know, sin is as painful to our soul as injuries are to our body. Without mitzvos, our soul is hungry like our body is hungry without food. And when the Jewish people are in that state, we're close to spiritual perfection, therefore the spiritual deficiencies are immediately manifest. And that's the laws of tzaras. When someone does a sin, either one of those seven sins, but primarily the sin of Lashon Hara, it's going to be immediately reflected in a sprouting of tzaras on their body, on their person, or on their garments, or on their home. And what happens? So we're given initially an introduction. The first several verses of the chapter give us an introduction, and then we go into detail of the various different types of tzaras and how they are addressed, how they're evaluated, and how they are maybe remediated, as we covered in Parshas Metzora. So the first thing we see is that when someone has a tzaras, a skin affliction, they have to bring it to the Kohen. Only the Kohen, only the priest, can render a ruling. It will become a tzaras, affliction on the skin of his flesh. He shall be brought to Aaron the Kohen, or to one of his sons of the Kohanim. So this is a verse that tells us that the only person that can render a ruling, the only doctor of tzaras, is Aaron and Aaron's children. Now, it is interesting. It doesn't mention a generic Kohen. It specifically talks about Aaron and Aaron's children. And why? The question is why? You know, why can't I just say the Kohen? Bring it to the Kohen. Why does it have to say Aaron or Aaron's children? Why does it have to right away go to the most impressive of all the priests, Aaron? And I think the answer is that, you know, someone gets tzaras, in effect, it's a direct message from God. You did a blunder. You did a sin. And you need to be encouraged to mend your ways and to repent. But you know what's not pleasant to hear? It's not pleasant to hear this kind of criticism. No one wants to hear what they did wrong. No one wants to have their sins listed to them. It's a very difficult thing to absorb. Says the Torah, you go to Aaron. What was Aaron's outstanding quality? That he loved every person. He loved peace. He pursued peace. He did everything he can to make people feel as wonderful, as comfortable as possible, and to help them and to encourage them and to give them warmth and give them love. Someone like Aaron. Of course, it's the Kohen. But the Torah hints that you have to have the Aaron attitude to be an effective Kohen vis-a-vis these laws, because you're going to have to give the very uncomfortable message to the people who have tzaras. What happens? I'm sorry, you have tzaras. You must have sinned. It's a very difficult thing for a person to hear. You have to harness, the Kohen has to harness their internal Aaron quality, where they genuinely are interested in the betterment, the well-being of the people that they're talking to. Someone who has that attitude, indeed, they will be effective. You have to be like Aaron in order to render judgment. If the priest rules that the person is contaminated, then they have to go in isolation. They have to go outside the camp and they have to contemplate what they did. And of course, this is part of a repentance process. You think about what you did, you dwell upon it, and hopefully you'll mend your ways. And then the illness, which was only a manifestation of the spiritual malady, will go away too. The symptoms will disappear with the cause disappearing. Someone who speaks slanderously about other people, someone who sows division, has to be sent outside to isolation. You cause division, therefore you are divided away from other people. You have to warn other people to stay away from you. You're not allowed to walk within the 4 cubits of another person. You're excommunicated. And all that, these are not punishments. These are means to encourage repentance, encourage expiation, encourage someone to evaluate what they did, to contemplate what they are and their actions and their deeds, and hopefully to amend them, to fix them. There are cases where the Kohen is not certain. Is this tzaras? Is it not tzaras? Such a person will be quarantined for 7 days or maybe an additional 7 days. And you read the chapter, there's different kinds of colors. There's different shades. There's laws governing burns or inflammations. Is the wound oozing? Is it stabbed over? Tzaras on the head, on the face? Was there hair there? Is there bald spots in the front, in the back? Is it a normal skin disease? Is it tzaras? These are some of the laws that we see over here. And I think instead of going into the nitty-gritty detail of all these laws, I want to try to focus on what lessons that we could draw. So for example, verse 13 of chapter 13 gives us a very interesting situation. What if someone's entire body is totally covered with tzaras, with this skin malady? So the law is that they are actually rendered as being pure. And as an aside, this proves conclusively that this is not about leprosy. If someone is completely covered with leprosy, then they're ever more dangerous, ever more they should be isolated from the rest of the people. Clearly, it's a spiritual disease, and therefore, for some reason, when the person is entirely spiritually covered with tzaras, then they're pure. So what's the rationale behind that? So the Kliyakar, one of the commentaries, tells us that after all, the entire purpose of the tzaras is to coax someone to repent. If someone has it on every square inch of their body, for sure they repented, and therefore you don't need to go through the whole process because the person has surely repented. And the Talmud actually tells us an amazing idea in the Book of Sanhedrin, page 97a. It says that Messiah will come in one of two different ways, either a generation that's entirely righteous or a generation that's entirely wicked. And it proves it from this verse. What does it mean that if the generation is entirely wicked, that Messiah will come? That generation is obviously wicked. So why would Messiah come to such a people? Says the Talmud, quotes our verse, if everything is impure, if the entirety of his skin has been covered in white, then such a person is indeed pure. And therefore, if the entire generation has been covered in impurity, then Messiah will come. And my grandfather explained the idea behind this is that for impurity to reign, you have to have a little bit of purity. If there's not a scintilla of purity, if there's nothing good, then the bad cannot flourish. And this is an interesting idea, that when society devolves and devolves and devolves and devolves to such a degree that there's nothing good left, then it implodes upon itself. It has nothing to give it life, has no truth that it could grasp upon. And therefore, the whole thing ceases to exist and the evil disappears and all you have left is good. An amazing insight that we see here in the idea of purity and impurity. There has to be a little bit of purity in the impurity for the impurity to have vitality and continuity. Now, there's another interesting idea that we see here in verse 19. What happens when someone is healed and then on the place where the inflammation was, meaning where the heal, where the person was healed, then there is another manifestation of the tzara. So the person had an illness, it was healed, and then they're having a second illness. Maybe the idea behind this is, you know, someone has an illness and they get healed. Their job is to focus, what did I do wrong to get this bruise, to get this ailment, and how do I make sure it doesn't happen again? And therefore, if someone has an illness, and specifically in that same place, a second illness sprouts, the lesson that they forgot was to do a post-illness reckoning. They forgot to examine their deeds afterwards, and therefore they're reminded again, don't forget about this, because you may have the same problem if you don't address the underlying cause of that problem. There's another interesting law here in chapter 13, and that's the bohak, which is certain white spots on the skin that are not impure. They do not render the person as a metzora, someone who has tzaras. Yet, we're told in the verse, in verse 38, that the person needs to show it to the Kohen, and the Kohen will declare that he is pure. Now, the question is, if the person is pure, then why would you need to show it to the Kohen? Maybe the answer to that is, you know, even things that are not fully tzaras, if you have things that change in your life, if you have suddenly have white spots sprouting, it's probably a good idea to do some soul searching. Yes, it's not tzaras, but we have to find out what it is and hopefully address it before it gets out of hand. So we're given all these laws governing how to, someone is rendered into a metzora, into someone who has tzaras. And then in verse 45 and 46, we're told what has to happen to them. And the person with tzaras in whom there is an affliction, his garments shall be rent. You've got to cut your garments. His hair shall be unshorn, no haircuts. He shall cloak himself up to his lips. He shall call out, contaminate. Contaminate is to warn everyone that he's contaminated. All the days of his affliction are upon him. He shall remain contaminated. He is contaminated. He shall dwell in isolation. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. Again, this is all means to help him recognize what he did, recognize what brought him to that, and hopefully fix it so that way he'll solve his problem and eventually the manifestation will go away as well. There's an interesting Ibn Ezra here comment on this idea, on this verse, that the laws governing a metzora, someone has tzaras, are very similar to the laws governing someone who is a avel, who is a mourner. And he tells us that the reason why someone who has tzaras has to mourn, they're not mourning on the symptom, they have to mourn on the activities that brought them the symptoms. And I think maybe this is a powerful idea. If something bad happens to us, we're sad. What the Ibn Ezra would tell us is that we have to be sad, not because of the consequence of our action, not because of what happened to us, but because of what actually caused that. And using that attitude of thinking, what did I do wrong to deserve this? That will hopefully lead us to fix that and to rectify it and solve the cause of the symptoms and not just dwell and ruminate on the symptoms itself. And then verse 47, we read about what happens when a garment has tzaras. It could be a fabric. It could be a leather garment. It could be tzaras in the various different ways that the warp and the woof, which means essentially the way these things are woven. They're woven horizontally and vertically into a garment. If someone has tzaras, if someone has the spiritual affliction on their garment, an individual has on their skin, they're quarantined, and depending upon the circumstance of the garment's either declared pure or it's cleaned, and if it goes away, then great. It could be completely burnt if it doesn't go away, or other instances that only the part which was discolored is torn out and burned, but the rest of the garment is okay. So that's the parsha. It covers a few verses regarding a woman who has a baby, and the rest of the parsha dedicated to the idea of tsaras, the idea of this ailment that could afflict our garments or our body. And like we said at the beginning, this is important to not view this in a very physical light, that this is leprosy. And when someone is a leper, we don't want them to contaminate anyone else. We quarantine them. We send them outside of the camp. It is, according to almost all the commentaries, viewed as a spiritual ailment that is manifested when someone is spiritually acute in a physical, tangible way as a means to get them to repent. Next week, we're going to talk about the laws of tsaras when they afflict someone's home, and also when someone has tsaras, how is their ailment, how is it remedied?